This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour, the part of the program which we ceremoniously call the big picture, in which we try to tell you what the big picture is saying by making sense of all the dots. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. This week, everybody was focused on Singapore and President Trump's meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. But in this part of the world, in Washington and in Europe, there were actually bigger events taking place with somewhat of a yawn, very little attention being paid to it. And yet these events are going to affect the markets in the days, months, and year to come. So this is really important that we discuss them right here on the program.
Yeah, this was really a major week in terms of central banks. We had three major central banks meeting this week. We had the Fed, and they made their announcement on Wednesday. Thursday, there was another major announcement coming from the ECB. And Friday, we had the Bank of Japan, which virtually did nothing. It could have been a yawn. But if you take a look at what happened this week, two central banks announced policy changes that are going to impact the financial markets in the months ahead. And said Fed tightening usually precedes recessions and bear markets. If policy doesn't change, we could be looking at another recession and bear market in the not-too-distant future. Now, I want to begin today with an analogy, and I want you to picture this in your mind as we kind of frame our discussion today. And I want you to keep it there to better understand where we are today and where we're going to be heading in the next 12 to 18 months, a recession and another bear market. Now, here's the analogy I want to use. Picture yourself, you're on a beach in Florida. The sky is clear blue, winds are moderate, the seas are calm, the weather is balmy, it's a beautiful day. But 1,000 miles offshore, off West Africa, several tropical depressions are forming. They're gathering strength, and what we don't know is where and when they will hit landfall, the direction, or if they'll remain just out at sea. We just know they're coming and they're on their way. If you take that analogy, the Florida beach is the United States, has the best growing economy and the best financial markets this year. Their hurricane season is the central bank tightening cycle, which is gathering pace, as we saw this week with announcements from the ECB and especially the Fed. And we're going to go and dive in detail because it really surprised me, John, at the press conference this week that more wasn't given to the things the Fed said, the things it admitted, and the things it was telling the market it was getting ready to do. So we're going to dive into that today. And then we're going to talk about two storm fronts, or the two possible storms that we're going to see. You're seeing parts of it right now in the emerging markets. We'll talk about another one. But I want you to keep that image as we work our way through today's big picture. This week, the barometer began to drop and the storm fronts are forming.
For the past few years, we've been gradually raising interest rates, and along the way, we've tried to explain the reasoning behind our decisions. In particular, we think that gradually returning interest rates to a more normal level as the economy strengthens is the best way the Fed can help sustain an environment in which American households and businesses can thrive. Today, we've taken another step in that process by raising our target range for the federal funds rate by a quarter of a percentage point.
That came from the press conference following the FOMC meeting. But what was being said here is not just the fact that they were raising, but there was a lot more encapsulated here.
Yeah, what they did at that press conference and at the FOMC meeting, they upped the ante this week. It was at the beginning of the year. They were going to raise interest rates three times. If you take a look at the dot plot, they are now projecting four increases, basically a quarter of a point at every quarterly meeting, and that would take the Fed funds rate up to 2.5% by the end of the year. In addition to that, and this was accompanying the minutes that were issued following the FOMC meeting, John, they lopped off about 80 words of longstanding language that have been present in every one of those accompanying statements following the meeting. And the real key here is they were always saying we were likely to remain for some time below levels that are expected to prevail in the long run. What the Fed was basically saying up until this week is we're going to keep rates at below normal levels. We're going to keep them that way for a while. They removed all of that language. Translation, instead of leaning with the economy, they are now going to start leaning against the economy. In fact, in their own economic projections, you can see the result of what they plan to do. They raised their GDP projections for this year. They raised them this year to 2.7, between 2.7 and 3%. Next year, they're lowering that to 2.2 to 2.6. And in 2019, they're saying the economy will be growing at less than 2%. What the Fed is saying is we're going to start raising interest rates and leaning against the economy, and we are going to slow it down. Well, they normally don't. They usually put it in a recession. So even by their own admission, they see their rate hikes impacting the economy. They also see the impact of those policies raising the unemployment rate to what they feel is a sustainable rate at 4.5%.
What we've done here, by the way, for listeners is we've included the Fed's projections on our website. You can look at their dot plot on their economic forecast. But the irony, Jim, we've talked a lot about how President Trump and the Congress are working one way, say, to try to reduce taxes to give a boost to the economy at the same time the Fed is tightening. But likewise, they're trying to get the unemployment numbers down. That's what President Trump and the administration are doing. And the Fed is saying they're trying to raise them up because they think they're too low. And that you're going to have to explain to me. I don't know how more people out of work is a good thing.
It gets to a theory that the Fed adheres to, and this is the Phillips curve, which basically says the lower the unemployment rate, the higher the inflation rate. Now, we haven't really seen it up until this point, although we now are starting to see inflation creep up and may get up to 2.5%, maybe to 3%. But this idea is the Phillips curve is basically the lower the unemployment rate, theoretically, the higher the inflation rate. So when the Fed sees the unemployment rate dropping, and you got to remember, a lot of this is just theory. If you can recall going back to Yellen's chairmanship, she thought that, you know, once we get the unemployment rate down to 5%, then we're going to start moving aggressively. Well, when it got down to 5%, they started raising interest rates. Well, here we are. We're at 3.8%, and they're projected, if the economy keeps going as it is, because the LEIs are turning up, so Q2 and Q3 of this year are pointing to higher economic growth, we should see that unemployment rate come down to 3.5% or 3.6%. So what they're doing is they're saying, look, there's a risk here, but we need to normalize policy. And I want to go to, they had another clip in the press conference that I found rather interesting. And the Fed chairman was talking about the risk for the Fed is if they raise too slow, then they risk starting another financial bubble like we had in the last decade. If they raise it too fast, they could throw the economy into a recession. But they also pointed to something that they're going to do, and we're going to explain the significance of that, which is hold a press conference. Right now, the Fed holds about 4 press conferences quarterly, and in between then, they don't have a press conference accompanying the meeting. This time, for example, when they had the May meeting, they didn't have a press conference. Beginning January of 2019, they're going to have a press conference following every FOMC meeting. We'll talk about the implications of that. But John, play that clip about the press conference and raising and lowering too fast.
History has shown that moving interest rates either too quickly or too slowly can lead to bad economic outcomes. We think the outcomes are likely to be better overall if we're as clear as possible about what we're likely to do and why. To that end, we try to give a sense of our expectations for how the economy will evolve and how our policy stance may change. As chairman, I hope to foster a public conversation about what the Fed is doing to support a strong and resilient economy. And one practical step in doing so is to have a press conference like this after every one of our scheduled FOMC meetings. And we're going to do that beginning in January. That will give us more opportunities to explain our actions and to answer your questions. I want to point out that having twice as many press conferences does not signal anything about the timing or pace of future interest rate changes. This change is only about improving communications.
You know, I thought this was rather new, and I think I know why they're going to do that. It is going to, number one, give them a little bit more flexibility, because the thought was they would only raise interest rates at quarterly meetings when they were holding a press conference. What Powell was saying there, we're going to start having press conferences every single meeting. And I also think by the time they get to January of next year, if they raise rates in September, as the markets are anticipating, as the Fed just said, and also again in December, you're going to start seeing a lot more turbulence coming to this market. And maybe those press conferences will be used to try to calm the market, because if they go again in September, they go again in December, they're going to take that Fed funds rate to 2.5%. And you're already starting to see the turbulence and volatility return to this market. And we'll talk about the implications of that. But let's go to clips number 3 and 4, which were also significant. Number one, where they talk about the rise in oil prices doesn't really bother them. In other words, they see that as temporary, but also removing forward guidance. This was a big thing that Bernanke came and adopted when he was Fed chairman, was forward guidance was a way the Fed wanted to sort of let the markets know, hey, this is what we're going to do. We're going to keep rates steady. We're going to remove taper, or we're going to start raising interest rates. But they wanted to calm the markets. Just think of all the turbulence that we had between 2007 and 2009. And then think of the flash crash in 2010, the turbulence we had in 2011 with all the events, the Arab Spring, Fukushima, the downgrading of U.S. debt, the pig crisis. And then once again in 2013 when they had the taper tantrum. So press conferences and removing forward guidance. Let's listen to what Powell had to say about those two issues.
The recent inflation data have been encouraging, but after many years of inflation below our objective, we do not want to declare victory. We want to ensure that inflation remains near our symmetric 2% longer run goal on a sustained basis. As we note in our statement of longer run goals and monetary policy strategy, the committee would be concerned if inflation were running persistently above or below our 2% objective. Of course, many factors affect inflation, some temporary and others more lasting, and at any given time, inflation may be above or below 2%. For example, the recent rise in oil prices will likely push inflation somewhat above 2% in coming months, but that transitory development should have little, if any, consequence for inflation over the next few years. As we continue to note in our statement, we expect to make further gradual increases in that rate. As a result, if the economy evolves broadly as we anticipate, the federal funds rate will, over the next year or so, move well within the range of estimates of the normal long-run level. Therefore, we thought that now is an appropriate time to remove this forward guidance from our policy statement.
You know, the one nice thing to say about that is the Fed wasn't concerned about oil prices, but let me tell you, overseas, they are. And the reason is oil is denominated in dollars. So it's not just the fact that foreigners like the country of India that are screaming, they're seeing the price of oil rise, but also it's rising more for them because as the dollar rises against other global currencies, they're not only paying higher oil prices, but also their currencies are depreciating against the dollar, which is costing them even more. And so, you know, the Fed may not be concerned about the price of oil, and that's good because the only thing they can do about oil prices is basically to cut economic growth by raising interest rates substantially. But what I thought was significant about removing forward guidance is what they're going to do, it gives them more flexibility and it doesn't box themselves into the corner. So if they raise in September and all of a sudden they start seeing the LEIs begin to roll over, the unemployment rates start to go up, it should give them a little bit more flexibility because what they don't want to do is they want to maintain their credibility with the market. So if they say they're going to do one thing, they want to follow through and do that. So basically by removing forward guidance, It's going to keep the markets a lot more on the, I would say, guessing side in terms of what the Fed is going to do. Because as long as they had language in the minutes accompanying the meeting that said, we are going to keep this or we're going to do this. If you take a look at the minutes accompanying this week's meeting, almost 80 words were removed. All the things about accommodation and guidance were completely removed from the Fed minutes. So basically, you're going to see more volatility come into the markets because it's going to keep anybody following the Fed guessing in terms of what they're going to do. So they're going to need it, these press conferences, because their own actions are going to wreak havoc with global economics that could spill over here, and they will need to react and reverse course quickly. We're going to talk about the elephant in the room in that press conference that really surprised me. I was looking for financial reporters to ask the question we're going to raise here. That would have been one of the first things I would address to the Fed chairman. It wasn't, but the Fed did point out that they are doing two additional items. John, let's go with clips 5 and 6 when they talk about the additional items that they will be adding in terms of policy.
First, our program for reducing our balance sheet, which began in October, is proceeding smoothly. Barring a material and unexpected weakening in the outlook, this program will proceed on schedule and our balance sheet will continue to shrink. As we have said, changing the target range for the federal funds rate is our primary means of adjusting the stance of monetary policy. And finally, as discussed in the minutes of our May meeting, we're making a small technical adjustment in one of our tools for implementing monetary policy. To keep the federal funds rate in the target range, we rely on the rate of interest on excess reserves, or the IOER rate. Up until now, we have set the IOER rate at the top of the target range for the federal funds rate. In recent months, the federal funds rate has moved up toward the IOER rate as short-term interest rates have risen more generally. So to move the federal funds rate closer to the middle of the target range, we are now setting the IOER rate 5 basis points below the upper end of the target range. This minor technical adjustment has no bearing on the appropriate path for the federal funds rate or financial conditions more generally. Committee participants generally believe that the fiscal changes, that includes both the tax cuts, individual and corporate, and the spending changes, will provide meaningful support to demand, significant support to demand over the course of the next 3 years. And the other question is, what about the supply side? So it makes sense that if you lower corporate tax rates and allow faster expensing of investment, you will encourage greater investment. That should drive productivity. That should increase potential output.
He's talking about the fiscal stimulus that's coming into the economy. But he's also talking about they're going to continue to shrink their balance sheet. They're going to continue to raise interest rates. They've removed forward guidance. They've removed all the accommodative language. This is a Fed that is getting more aggressive. And the takeaway that you can walk away from that press conference and this meeting is they are now going to get more aggressive and lean against the economy, because up until this time, all the language, the things that they were saying is, hey, we're going along with the economy. We're going to do everything to accommodate the economy. Now they're going in the opposite direction. And more important for markets, and one of the things that we've addressed here on the program in the past, I've got 3 issues that will probably go into a book I'm going to write, 3 things that we've identified here. Last March, we talked about the bubble that was developing index funds. Last summer, we talked about financial concentration. And then just about a month ago, we talked about liquidity risk to this market. And right there, one of the main central banks in the world is removing liquidity from the markets at a very substantial pace. And we'll get to the ECB. The ECB is doing as well. So a lot of this ocean of money that has been flooding these markets, elevating markets here for the last 9 years, basically 2 of the biggest central banks in the world are telling the markets, we're taking away that liquidity or removing the punch bowl. The message, the punch bowl is being taken away. So markets, be on alert.
I think if you were to try to interpret this, what we're saying here is that removal of significant language, increasing rate hikes to 4 instead of 3 and getting rid of forward guidances, removing a lot of the props that have helped to guide this market in the past. So this really is a major change. Now, the real question I think we have to ask in all seriousness is how high will they ultimately go? Because originally it was going to be 3 raises this year. Now they're switching it to 4, but indicating that they're going to go after that as well. So how high is the sky?
Well, I mean, right now, if they go 4 times this year, we'll end up with the Fed funds rate at 2.5. They're projecting that they'll raise interest rates an additional 3 times next year and an additional 2 times in 2020. Personally, I don't think they're going that far. Of course, I was wrong. I thought they were only going to go 3, and they still could go 3 if things really start to move in the opposite direction and we see more turbulence in storms overseas. Here's the scary part. They simply don't know, as Powell explained at the press conference, they are still in a learning curve as they go. In that learning curve, unfortunately, they're playing with the fate of the economy and the markets and also jobs. Let's go to that clip, John, which I found fascinating when they asked him, you know, a reporter asked him, what is the neutral rate? How high do you guys plan on taking interest rates? And he basically says, we sort of don't know. We're kind of learning as we go along.
We're learning about the real location of the natural rate of unemployment as we go. So it's moved down by more than a full percentage point since 2012. So it's not so simple as thinking, well, boy, we've just got to go ahead and get that rate up. If you look at the forecasts, 2 years from now, end of 2020, you're still seeing inflation very close to target. So there's no sense in our models or in our projections or forecasts that inflation will take off or move unexpectedly quickly from these levels, even if unemployment does remain low.
So there's a part that really kind of disturbed me, because they are just experimenting. And the thing about monetary policy, it operates within a lag by the time it works its way through the economy in higher interest rates. And we'll talk about the impact of that here in just a moment. But one of the things that we're seeing as a result of this week's action is the yield curve is beginning to flatten. The 2-year note was at 2.558 on Friday. The 10-year note was at 2.9. So there's only about 34 basis points separating the two. Now, does this invert or just flatten inversions or indications of an approaching recession? To avoid that, we would need the long end to steepen. As many of the technicians on this program have talked about, the 10-year note rising to maybe 3.25 to 3.5 range. Some of our experts are predicting that, but we're going to need rising inflation to make that happen, because right now, the difference in spread and yields in the turbulence overseas is bringing money into the U.S., and especially corporations that are repatriating money back here to the U.S. That is sort of flattening the long end of the yield curve, keeping long-term rates low. And of course, as every meeting, let's say in September, if they raise rates, we will be at 2.25. So you could see the 2-year notes start to steepen. And especially if they go again in December, we could see 2-year treasury notes at 3% or above. And whether the yield curve steepens or it flattens, a lot of that's going to depend on what we see in inflation.
You know, Jim, you have to really think about this, too. I mean, when they say, well, we're not too sure what we're doing, we're experimenting this. These are supposed to be the experts that are setting the policy for us. I'm going, okay, it's
Can you imagine? Yeah. They're wheeling you into an operating room. You have, they're about ready to do heart surgery on you. And the surgeon comes in and goes, not sure what we're doing here today, but we're kind of learning along the way.
Right.
You feel a little nervous, wouldn't you?
That's what I'm thinking. It's like, oh, my God, Martha, we're in trouble. You know, so you do it. And, you know, at the press conference, they said they expected the yield curve to flatten and to narrow as they raise rates. But they're still not talking about recession here.
Yield curve is something that people are talking about a lot, including FOMC participants. You have a range of views. It's something we're going to continue to be talking about, but it's only one of many things, of course, that we talk about. I think that that discussion is really about what is appropriate policy and how do we think about policy as we approach the neutral rate? How do we understand what the neutral rate is? How do we know where it is and what are the consequences of being above or below it? That's really what, when people are talking about the slope of the yield curve, that's really what they're talking about. We know why the yield curve is flattening. It's because we're raising the federal funds rate, it makes all the sense in the world that the short end would come up.
You know, and I should point out, by the way, in listening to that, is you've always said here on the show, you know, that they keep raising rates until something breaks. And I go, oh, that's really a great way to do it. Try running an airplane like that one. But it was the same thing with the unemployment rate. Well, we don't sort of know what we're doing here, blah, blah, blah. But I guess what you're taking out of this is that this was really, what would we call it? And it's not a watershed event, but it's a key change.
Yeah, I mean, the key takeaway from this meeting, press conference will accompany every FOMC meeting beginning in January, which leaves them free to raise rates at every meeting should they decide to do so. The other thing is they remove forward guidance. So there's nothing that says, hey, we're going to go slow. All of the stuff, we're going to go slow, keep things easy. All of that now has been removed. The message to investors and business, the Fed is now working against you. It's shrinking its balance sheet, removing liquidity. It's raising rates. And as that liquidity is removed from the markets, it's going to raise the cost of borrowing. Mortgage rates are going up. Car loans are going up. Credit card loans are going up. Home equity loans are going up. So one of the problems when the Fed does this, and this is why they end up crashing the airplane most of the time, there's a lag effect between the time you raise interest rates and it works its way through the economy. Sooner or later, potential homeowners are going to go and look for a home, and they're going to find that the interest rates are no longer cheap, and it's going to be more difficult to qualify. Or because of rising interest rates, they're not going to be able to buy as expensive of a house. And as we pointed out in hour one with my guest from CoreLogix, Molly, is they expect real estate prices to continue to rise another 6% in the next year or two. And they also expect that we could see up to 6% mortgage rates. Now, contrast that to a little over a year ago when mortgage rates were only 3.5%. Now we're talking 4.5% and maybe 5.5 and 6. The problem for the Fed is monetary policy acts with a lag. So, John, they won't know when they've gone too far until it's too late. Another problem that we have here is the Fed models in many ways are flawed when we take a look at the Phillips curve. The lower the unemployment rate, the higher the inflation rate. Well, they thought that was going to happen at 6% unemployment. It was going to happen at 5% unemployment. It was going to happen at 4% unemployment. It hasn't happened so far. Now, inflation is beginning to pick up. We're seeing it in the prices paid components. We're seeing it in CPI. We're also seeing it in PPI. And you could see that at least in the next 6 months, you should see inflation start to go up. That's going to breed more volatility in the market. And in the Fed's mind, if you look at where they're thinking, the natural unemployment rate is around 4.5. We're below that right now. I want to move on, John, to another central bank that met the day after, which is the ECB, because they announced several things that they were changing, including finishing their taper. By the end of the year, the ECB will stop buying bonds in the market.
Three decisions made this morning by the European Central Bank. One, it's going to taper quantitative easing beginning in October. Now doing 30 billion euros a month, going to taper it down to 15 for October, November, December, ending it in December. Two, going to keep reinvesting the proceeds from all of that paper that it holds until well past the end of QE. No date certain given on that, but that's something that kind of eases the effect of this. It's going to maintain a very big balance sheet over some time. Pretty similar language to what the Federal Reserve used. And three, it will keep interest rates, now currently at zero and minus 0.4 on its two major benchmarks, unchanged at least until the summer. And the governing council remains willing to adjust that as the certainty about hitting its inflation target goes up and down. Another new information here is the outlook for GDP. They brought it down a little bit for 2018, down to 2.1 in 2018, 1.9 in 2019, 1.7 in 2020. Around trend is where they think they're going to get to, but that excess GDP we've had from Europe, the ECB sees going away.
So a couple of things that were going there. They're going to end tapering, meaning they're going to stop buying bonds in the market, but they're not going to shrink their balance sheet as the Fed is doing now. And they're not even going to begin raising interest rates until September of next year. Right now, the deposit rate in Europe is a negative 0.4%. And what they're trying to do here is they're kind of trying to tread a careful path between ending a contentious stimulus policy. The Germans were not in favor of QE, and that's close to being exhausted. Plus, they're running out of bonds to buy. And the other thing they want to avoid, and this, once again, could be a crisis point, a sharp appreciation of the euro and European bond yields, because there's a lot of countries that are heavily laden with debt. Remember the pig crisis, and remember recently in the last couple of weeks, the spike in Italian bond yields. So the ECB is doing everything it can to prevent investors pricing a rising interest rate market before September of next year. The result was the euro fell from about $1.18 down to $1.16. Now, we had another central bank meet on Friday, because that was the whole thing this week. We had the Fed, the ECB, and the Bank of Japan. They met this week. The BOJ decided Friday to stick to its ultra-easy monetary policy, probably the last major central bank, bucking global trends that we've seen recently in Canada, the U.S., the ECB, the Bank of England, because they're not even close to their 2% target rate. So in the past year, we have seen a lot more central banks step in. And, you know, we've been on this easy money path for almost 8 years, 9 years now. Now the monetary environment is changing dramatically. And as I always say here on the program, they will keep raising interest rates until they break something. And there was every indication, listening to that meeting and press conference, they intend on accelerating things. And as they announced, instead of 3, it's going to be 4, and they're going to continue to shrink their balance sheet at the same time, which is also another form of tightening.
You know, Jim, in the past, you've identified 3 themes here on the program. If we go to March of last year, we talked about the bubble in passive index investing. Summer of last year, we discussed financial concentration, meaning the quantity of money in low numbers of hands. And now recently, we were talking about liquidity. Now, as you see all of these 3 different areas of risk, can these 3 storm fronts merge to form a perfect financial storm? And if so, looking at these changes, both from the Federal Reserve and from the European Central Bank, how does this play out?
Well, let's begin with the dollar, because remember the analogy I started today's big picture. I said, you're out on the beach, everything's looking good, but about 1,000 miles away off the west coast of Africa, tropical depressions are forming. And what is causing those tropical depressions to form? One of them is a rising dollar. The rising dollar impacts the economy in many ways. Number one, it damages world trade. Number two, it tightens financial conditions. And number three, it leads to periods of market panic and risk off. And we're seeing emerging markets with large dollar assets are the most vulnerable. The real danger as to what the Fed is now doing is that the Fed has a high tolerance for dollar strength. They view the U.S. as sort of a closed economy because the U.S. is less dependent on foreign imports than, let's say, Asia, emerging markets, or Europe. I mean, 50% of Germany's economy is exports. What this means is they are ignoring large and important spillover effects to their policies between the U.S. and the rest of the world. And we saw this happen in the past. In 2014 and 2015, the Fed signaled its intention to raise rates. Remember taper? They announced taper in 2013. It began in 2014. And at the time they did this, they announced it anyway, despite global deflationary pressures that we were seeing in Asia and Europe and an aggressive stimulus program elsewhere. The results were a powerful surge in the dollar, a slowdown in EM markets, the risk-off trade came into play, declining CapEx, and a recession in U.S. manufacturing. So in essence, the dollar is the world's currency, but the Fed isn't a global central bank, even though many of its actions are affecting so much of what we're seeing take place in the markets right now. For almost a decade, And this is where we're leading into this crisis in the storm front that's building. Because if you think about what the Fed did after the financial crisis, they drove interest rates down to zero. Then they started quantitative easing. And so countries around the globe, which trade in dollars, invoice in dollars, they enjoyed the benefits of that easy Fed policy because they could borrow cheaply in dollars. Now they're starting to feel the uglier side of that reversal in policy. And certainly, we've seen an increase in market volatility recently. And things investors used to ignore last year, trade policies, high market valuations, oil prices, seem to matter more today.
To reiterate what we just said, or what, you know, what you've been saying here on the program for a long time, is the Fed raises rates until something breaks. That's their indicator, you know, their meter. And right now, the Fed is raising interest rates significantly and signaling that it intends to do so even more. But as they do, we will expect, and we are seeing, things to start going wrong. So far here, things are okay. But we are seeing the impact of policies in emerging markets. Look at what's going on in Argentina, Brazil, and of course, what just happened recently in Italy. So the first cracks are developing.
Yeah, and as the Fed continues to raise interest rates, which they indicated this week, they intend to do so and even more than they were originally anticipated, that is going to widen the spread between the rest of the world significantly, causing the dollar to strengthen. Now, a rising dollar is bad news for the financial markets because it affects the global economy in at least three ways. The first way it impacts it, it reduces world trade volume since most countries, with the exception of the euro, which trading within the euro is billed with euros, but most countries in international trade invoice in the U.S. dollar. The second way it impacts the globe, it discourages risk-taking and hurts sentiment since the balance sheet of dollar borrowers deteriorates and international banks are less willing and able to provide cross-border lending. Because think of this. Let's say your currency, you've taken out loans, you've taken out $100 million of loans that are denominated in dollars, and your currency drops by 5% or 6% against the dollar. Well, what happens? You just have to pay more in interest. It's not just the interest you're paying on the dollars, but your currency, which you will have to exchange for dollars, those loans just got more costly. And it also disrupts global value chains. And finally, where this will start to impact the U.S., domestically, it reduces the profits of U.S. multinational corporations, which is why we're seeing the difference in terms of returns this year between the large cap indexes like the S&P 500 and the Dow and the smaller cap stocks like the Russell 2000 or the S&P mid-cap and small-cap stocks. So if the dollar appreciates, it is highly destructive both for the U.S. and elsewhere.
You know, if we could take a minute here to go into the mechanism of how the rising dollar becomes destructive, because what was really singularly lacking in the press conference was somebody asking about how these policies from the Fed are beginning to cause chaos or problems overseas.
Well, let's talk about world trade, since trade and trade wars, tariffs are in the news. Most international trade takes place in just a handful of currencies, the main one being the dollar. So a rising dollar or strength in the dollar is depressing world trade. And the main exception, once again, will be the euro, because European countries trade within themselves with the euro. So goods become more expensive. Number two, risk-taking. As the dollar increases, the source of funding for U.S. dollar-denominated debt begins to surge since the financial crisis. So there are a lot of countries, you can see this in graphs, and I'll be including it as I begin writing my book, which we're going to release in installments, but those loans become and have been a cheap source of funding. Because remember, for the longest time, the Fed kept interest rates at zero, and even when they started to raise them, they only raised them a quarter of a point. If you're starting from zero and you raise them a quarter of a point in 2015, and then the next year you only raise them a quarter of a point, the source of funding for most financing around the globe, the cheapest place was the dollar. And it's hard to believe, but if you think back, 2 years ago, the 10-year yield on a treasury note was 1.3%. Treasury bills were actually negative. So as the dollar appreciate, it hurts the balance sheets of those borrowers. And that's why you're starting to see problems in Brazil and Argentina. Argentina just got a $15 billion loan from the IMF. So it reduces both global demand and credit and makes those dollar loans more expensive. Another way, as the dollar strengthens, it has a powerful impact on global value chains. If you think about how things are made today, let's take a car manufacturer. You could have, for example, an engine for a car that's made in Japan. The transmission is made, let's say, in Canada. The parts are shipped to Mexico where they're assembled, and then final assembly in Mexico and then into the United States. So you're talking about the currencies of Canada, you're talking about the currencies of Mexico, you're talking about the currencies of Japan. As those currencies devalue against the dollar, as the dollar strengthens, think what is happening to your cost structure as you try to assemble things around the globe in different locations. So global value chains expanded rapidly over the last decade because it was easy to do so. The dollar was declining. It was kept low. It was easy to finance. But because these countries invoice their trade in dollars, they also need to borrow in the same currency. In fact, it's just like anything else. Most businesses will go in here in the U.S. They'll tap the commercial paper market for, let's say, short-term funding needs. The same thing happens at the international level, except for when you're trading in dollars, you're also borrowing in dollars. And so the dollar became a cheap source of funding. So these things are impacting the economy. And that was the one thing that really struck me, John. If I was in the audience in that press conference, that would have been the first thing I would have asked the Fed chairman, because we tend to be isolated here in the U.S. Less of our economy, we're more self-sufficient, and especially now with energy. So we're less inclined to think about what's happening overseas, and the Fed is more domestic oriented. But a lot of times the things they do, they may end up creating a crisis. So that is one of the things that if you want to look at where the storm fronts are going to come in this next crisis. The last one that started in 2007 was centered here. The epicenter was in the U.S. The next one is the epicenters are in Europe and emerging markets.
And I know what listeners are thinking to themselves right now. When and where will these storm fronts emerge?
I see two primary candidates. One is in Europe and the other one is in the emerging market. And in this next storm that takes place, the next downturn, in my opinion, the safest place will be is the U.S. We have the biggest economy, the most liquid markets, and the lowest levels of debt. Even though the deficits have gone up, our debt to GDP ratios compared to Japan, compared to China, compared to many of the countries in Europe and South America are small in comparison. So business cycles and bull markets, John, can persist for longer than investors think. One of the difficult things will be is to time when this starts to happen. But we're already starting to see the rumblings. We're seeing it take place in the emerging markets. We recently saw it take place in Italy. So as rates rise and spreads begin to widen, you are going to see an increase in volatility. And along with, I think what you're going to see in the next two quarters, a rise in higher inflation levels. This will cause the economy to weaken eventually. It will cause markets to fall. And as markets fall, it hits economic confidence. It creates this self-perpetuating feedback loop. So we are seeing that now as volatility spikes. We saw it a couple times earlier in this year in that downturn that we saw at the end of January. And as this happens, as markets become more volatile, as you see more events like this happen, what it does, it will cause the credit spreads in the markets begin to widen because investors will become more risk adverse. They will demand a higher rate of interest. And also it is going to weaken confidence. I mean, everybody feels good, even though you may not be invested in the market. When you hear news on the economy that the stock market is going up or it's hitting new records, everybody feels good. Another thing that you're going to see is rates rise. It'll begin to impact the multiples that are paid on stocks. In other words, PE multiples begin to contract, and eventually what we're going to be monitoring is both hard and soft data when it comes over in the economy. And I would suspect, John, by the time we get to probably the third quarter, the end of the third quarter, fourth quarter, our leading indicators that lead, or what I call our anticipatory indicators, are already telling and beginning to soften. So the LEIs are still looking pretty good, which means that the second and third quarter growth figures in the U.S. are looking pretty good. We'll probably be up at 3%, up from where we were in the first quarter.
So here we are, and what is holding up the market?
You want to take a look at it. It's basically one of the strongest factors behind this bull market is share buybacks and M&A activity. If you take a look at 2018, so far, year to date, we've had $2 trillion in merger activity. Let me put that in perspective. In the year 2000, when the market peaked, merger activity at the height of that market was $1.5 trillion. Fast forward to the peak of the market in 2007, it was 1.8. We're not even halfway through the year, and we're at $2 trillion. The other thing that you're starting to see is the spreads on low-quality credits. And I'm talking about CCC-rated bonds are very mispriced, in my opinion, now. When you take a look at the risk investors are taking to own these bonds that are basically owned in a lot of these high-yield funds, I mean, when you get in stressful times, the default rate can approach as high as 40%. It's normally 15 to 20%. So what you're likely to see going forward, and we're seeing it now, greater volatility, shrinking liquidity, vulnerabilities of a fragile global financial system that could come unhinged. So I want to go back to the beginning of this big picture. And I mentioned right now, that analogy I gave you, you're sitting on the beach, you're in Florida, the wind is calm, the sky's blue, it's balmy weather, everything looks okay. But the real problem is what's taking place about 1,000 miles out in those tropical depressions. So that is why over the last couple of programs we've done over the last couple months, it's time to start adding hedges. This cycle is not over yet, but after two more rate hikes, the blue skies are going to start to look more cloudy and more stormy, and it will begin to engulf many of these economies, whether it erupts first in the emerging markets or in Europe, as it did a couple of weeks ago in Italy. We simply don't know at this point.
So I think what we're looking at here is a turning point week. I'm not sure it's quite a watershed. It's simply a significant turn. It's probably a much bigger story that we're discussing here than people were really paying attention to with everything going on with the G7 and what happened in Singapore this last week. The Fed is now planning to lean against the economy. That's a good way of putting it. They're doing that by withdrawing liquidity. This is going to impact the markets. At the very same time, the European Central Bank is also withdrawing liquidity by ending its buying program by the end of the year. And if all of this is true, we should probably fasten our seatbelts because it's going to get a lot bumpier in the year to come. And in that light, what is it you're doing as far as investments, Jim?
You know, we've been adding hedges and, you know, we're not 100% invested. And, you know, we don't think we're smart enough to figure out the top or the day the market tops. And just like the markets were caught by surprise in January, we think more surprises lie ahead of us. However, I still think there's probably going to be one more topping process where you might see a significant rally towards the end of the year, but we're putting hedges in place. And if the Fed raises in September, which the futures market says they probably will, if they raise rates in December, which the futures market says they probably will, then, John, I would say by the end of the year, going into next year, it's going to be time to hunker down and ride out the storm. Because the one thing we simply do not know at this point, and this brings back my perfect storm analogy, We have an index and passive index funds. We have financial concentration in a handful of financial entities, and we have liquidity that's shrinking. And quite honestly, none of this has ever been stress test before. So we don't know what this is going to look like when it happens or when it hits the markets in full force. And you add index funds to high frequency trading, a lot of times you can see these downturns become fast and furious, happening much quicker before you even have a chance to react. The analogy I would use, if you were driving a car, you're driving down, barreling down the freeway at 85, 90 miles an hour, and all of a sudden something jumps out in front of the road in front of you. If you're going 30 and 40, you have time to react. When you're going 85 and 90, you don't. So we've never seen it. The only thing I would say is start putting in your hedges. And my goodness, folks, have yourself an exit plan. If you are in your 50s, you're 10 years away from retirement, or close to retirement, or just retired, you better have an exit plan.
Well, given all of that, I'm out of here. That's my exit plan. So as we exit the program here, what is it we're doing in the weeks to come? It's going to be an interesting rest of the year. I really think so.
Yeah. Next week. I think it's next week. We have a meeting coming up with OPEC where it's widely anticipated, at least we're thinking so, they will announce a gradual increase in production. Because if you take a look at what's going on in Venezuela, Venezuelan oil production could be down by another 500,000 barrels. And we still don't know the full extent of the sanctions against Iran. I've heard all kinds of figures, anywhere from 300,000 to 400,000 barrels all the way up to 1 million. But it is just absolute chaos in Venezuela right now. So OPEC does have room to increase its production and still stay within its limits. And I suspect they are going to probably say something that they will be increasing production already. Saudi Arabia is doing that. But you got to understand, in the kingdom during the summer, they consume more of their own product. The real key is going to be watching the export figures. And then once again, in about the next couple of weeks, we're going to be looking at the corporate earnings season for the second quarter. That will take us into the month of July and the first couple of weeks in August. August, we will have the annual conclave of the Federal Reserve in Jackson Hole. What I suspect is the message that was delivered at this week's press conference will be delivered and emphasized once again in August, probably indicating very much that in September, the Fed will be raising interest rates for the third time this year, and then probably hinting at another one coming in December. So lots of stuff to keep your eyes on in the weeks and months ahead. We'll be here to talk about it. In the meantime, on behalf of John Leffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.